Welcome today to our interview series with outstanding professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm speaking with Dr. Robert Atkinson, founding president, the IT Innovation Foundation. Rob is an internationally acclaimed leader in technology innovation and policy and author of Innovation Economics, The Race for Global Advantage. Rob, thank you for coming in today and sharing your work and experiences with our audience.
Stephen, thank you for having me.
So Rob, today we're going to really focus on this amazing book. So with regards to that, how are other nations outside the U.S. and Canada making support for technology and innovation a central tenet of their economic strategies and policies?
Well, you know, I think one of the biggest stories of the last decade that a lot of people have overlooked is the fact that lots and lots of countries now have decided that it's innovation that they're going to put at the centerpiece of their economic policies, and that they're going to back that up with national strategies. And with new institutions, with new monies, with new policies, with a whole set of things, because they see the benefits that innovation has brought to countries like Canada and the United States. And I think it presents a major challenge to both Canada and the United States if we don't step up our game.
So what would be needed to have a robust innovation policy?
Well, you know, the single, sounds simple, but the single biggest thing that's needed is an understanding that markets acting on their own, firms acting on their own in response to price signals, is not enough when it comes to maximizing the supply of innovation in an economy. Might be enough to maximize the supply of wheat or widgets or coal or whatever, or, you know, commodities. But innovation is a much more complex development. It's really about an ecosystem that has to work effectively. If you think about, for example, a typical company that wants to do some kind of innovation, oftentimes they are dependent upon other players in the ecosystem doing something at the same time. A good example of that would be health IT. You know, it's not enough for a software provider to come out with a really great piece of software for health records. You have to have doctors adopt it, and you have to have patients who want to use it. You have to have payers who want to use it. So one of the most important things, I think, for any country to figure to maximize their innovation potential is to, first of all, understand that they have to have an innovation strategy. It has to be thoughtful, it has to be detailed, and it has to really go down to both to the sectoral level and the technology level. You know, how are we doing in a whole set of different technologies around innovation, and how are those working, and what are the kinds of policies we need?
How did a weak innovation economy contribute to the Depression?
To the Great Recession. You know, this is one of those things where it's really surprising to us. We lay out in our book, it's surprising that no one has made the connection, I think, that we think is so critical. At least in the United States, and I think this is true, frankly, in some of the other countries where they had big housing bubbles and then collapses, like Spain and Ireland and the like, but certainly true in the United States. What you saw after 2000, when the housing bubble really began in the late 90s, 99 or so, and then just started growing dramatically. And it was growing at an unsustainable pace. Housing really should not be growing any faster than GDP, because it's not an investment. It's just simply, you know, it's like buying a sofa, or from my Canadian days when I lived in Canada, buying a Chesterfield. It's not an investment, just buying a bunch of wood and some bricks putting together. Anyway, what happened in the United States was that we basically were losing out in the global race for innovation advantage, and then the historical demand for investment capital that entrepreneurs had, that major multinational corporations had, that a whole set of companies would have. They would go to Wall Street or banks and they'd say, we need capital because we want to invest in wealth creation activities. That really shrank dramatically after 2000. And for example, the amount of, for example, new investment in machinery, equipment, and software grew about five times faster in the last half of the 90s than the entire 2000s. So what happened was you had this big decline in demand for capital, and Wall Street was unwilling to downsize. There was basically less demand for what they were providing, the services they were providing. They didn't want to downsize. And so they said, oh, we have an idea. Let's put money into mortgages. We'll turn mortgages into essentially bonds and an investment vehicle. And that was like a really, as we all know, an incredibly stupid idea. But our point is that the reason they did it, besides the fact that they were looking for short-term returns, was because the other things that they historically had invested in and made money on dried up and declined. And the reason for that was that America was losing its, as I said, its competitive advantage when it came to these innovation investments. So once all that happened, then money was flowing into housing. It became a bubble, an unsustainable bubble. It collapsed. And then we've had this, you know, anemic, very, very weak recovery, again, for very similar reasons, because our underlying core engine of innovation and competitiveness has been very weak.
I'm glad you corrected my word depression to recession, though it felt like a depression.
The worst that we've had since the Great Depression, and the fact that we are still in such an anemic jobs recovery, it's, you know, really unprecedented.
So let's extend the prior question. How is the weak innovation economy delaying the Canadian and U.S. recovery?
Well, you know, there's two ways that's happening. You know, if you talk to most economists, the ones on the left will say, look, if we just had more consumer spending, people would buy more things, companies then would realize that they have to hire more workers to produce the things that people want, and then you'd get back to this new equilibrium of, you know, 5% unemployment. Those on the right would argue, no, there's all this uncertainty, at least in the United States, around budget deficits, and everybody's sitting on the sideline because they all expect some huge tax cut in the future. I think both of those explanations are very, very weak. What you really have to look at is, well, why is there so much uncertainty, and why is there so little in investment growth? I mean, we're in the United States, we're still, U.S. corporations are investing less today than they were in 2006. So I think part of the fundamental reason is that we've lost competitive advantage. A good example of that in manufacturing, and by the way, Canada is even worse than the United States when it came to manufacturing loss in the last decade, and we're both pretty bad. It's us, Canada, the U.S., and Great Britain that really, but in the United States, we lost a third of our manufacturing jobs, a third of them. Over a 10-year period, that's never happened before in American history. We actually had declining manufacturing output. And that is, if you think about sort of Federal Reserve Bank parlance, that's a very, very stiff headwind. Now, what some people will say is, oh, isn't manufacturing coming back? And in fact, we've created a few manufacturing jobs in the U.S., but the reason people say there's a recovery going on, what they miss is the loss of manufacturing jobs in the Great Recession was the largest it's ever been since the Great Depression in the 30s. Every single recession except this one in 2000, we had recovered all of our manufacturing jobs, 3 years from the bottom of the trough. And here we've only recovered about maybe 15% of our manufacturing jobs that we've lost have been recovered. So I think that's one of the big reasons. We just haven't regained the losses that we should have. But I think the second reason, which is equally important, is if, I don't know if you ever saw that movie Men in Black, but there's a thing that Will Smith has that it's called a neuralizer, and when someone sees the aliens have come to the planet, they flash this light in front of them, and the people have lost their memory of this thing, you know, and it's like a funny story. But look, if the president could have a neuralizer that would just tell everybody in America, businesses, workers, investors, you know what, in 2020, United States is going to be the world's leading innovation economy. We will dominate. We will create new industries, life sciences, IT, nanotechnology. We're just going to be thriving. Just if people knew that and believed that in their heart of hearts and had faith that that was going to happen, you would see, I would predict a very, very different kind of economic activity and behavior going on right now. People would have regained what Keynes once called the animal spirits of capitalism. And I think in the United States, and frankly in Canada too, there's a deep-seated view that perhaps our best days are behind us, perhaps we're in slow decline, and that is a reflection, I think, partly of reality, but it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. So I think that's why it's so important for the United States and Canada to have a firm commitment that say we understand we're in this innovation, global innovation race, and that we want to win it.
So how does innovation in the U.S. compare with other developed and developing nations, including Canada?
Well, you know, the United States, you know, first of all, it's hard to fully compare innovation But if you look at a study that we did called the Atlantic Century 2, where we benchmark EU and US innovation competitiveness, and we look at 16 different variables around the world that we could get data on, things like how much corporate R&D there is, how much venture capital, how much new scientific publications, what's the rate of productivity growth, how many researchers do you have. Anyway, when you look at all those things, you put it together, the U.S. ranks fourth behind Singapore, Finland, and Sweden. Canada ranks seventh. But what I think is more interesting is not the snapshot, but the trend over time. And if you look at the trend over time, say over the last 12 years, who's made the most progress on those indicators? Who's moved up most on expanding the number of scientific researchers, on expanding their broadband, their business R&D, all of these indicators? What you find is that the United States is second to last. We're 43rd out of 44 countries, only in front of Italy. And Canada is 34th. So at least Canada does better than the United States, but Canada is somewhat still closer to the bottom. Now, it's true that a lot of the countries at the top are countries that are that started at a lower base, and so it's easier for them to catch up. No surprise, China's number one. But Korea's number two. You've got Austria, number 14. That's a developed country. Japan, number 17. Denmark, 20th. So we certainly aren't, United States, I should say, certainly isn't even keeping up with our developed nation partners. So part of that is just, as again, other countries have decided that that's something that's important to them. You know, good number, Stephen. I think that a lot of people would be surprised at. If you look at the amount of money that nations invest in research and development at their universities and colleges, most people would think that the United States is probably near the top because we've got some great universities, MIT and Stanford, Caltech, etc. In fact, out of 30 OECD countries, we're 22nd. And our rate of change is even worse. So what you find, again, is other countries, including Canada, I think Canada actually done a pretty good job on this one, have decided that, you know, it's in our national interest to make sure that we fund university R&D at a pretty high level. So, you know, I think those are some good indicators that suggest the U.S. isn't really doing. Another really good one that I think for the U.S. is the fact that a decade ago we were running a trade surplus in high technology products, and today we're not.
Oh, that's quite interesting. There was a presentation, a plenary presentation at the World Computer Congress specifically on this whole idea of innovation, and a question came from the audience about where does the U.S. stand, and it was interesting that sort of masses of people within the audience would say, well, U.S. is number one and it'll always be number one. So it's interesting, there's sort of that perception that U.S. will always be there, it's always ahead, and yet the facts indicate that, you know, that there's some work that the U.S. needs to do.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, there's really two reasons why. I mean, I get that response all over the world when I talk about our book, and I think there's two main reasons for it. Number one is you have to differentiate between the U.S. establishments and U.S. enterprises. In other words, U.S. companies versus the establishments that the establishment they have, the factories, the laboratories, the offices. U.S. companies actually are doing pretty well on innovation. You know, the GEs of the world, the IBMs of the world, Cisco. The problem is that the U.S. is not capturing the value from those companies the way they used to. They're still capturing some value from them, don't get me wrong. But you look at, for example, U.S. multinational companies over the last decade, they've expanded where they do their research and development spending 2.7 times faster overseas than they have in the United States. So I think that's one of the reasons people miss that, is they conflate U.S. companies with the U.S. economy, and those are not the same. The second reason, I think, is because we're so big. You know, compare us to Denmark. Well, that big is the wrong measure. So, you know, on that measure, we have 10 times more higher mortality rate than Canada does, because we have 10 times more people die every day than Canada does. We also have 10 times more people than Canada. So I think any fair assessment of a nation's innovation capacity really has to be adjusted on a per GDP or per worker basis. And then when you do that, then you get into a very, very different story. And actually, I'd say the last part of that is people oftentimes equate innovation to the things that they see on their daily life, which makes sense. And on that level, again, U.S. does pretty well. Seems like we all have iPads now, or we all use Google, or we all use Microsoft operating system. But if you look at the other component of innovation, which is essentially B2B innovation, in other words, inputs to companies, you look at the Japanese, for example, and there's about 70 different industries where they have over 70% global market share in high-tech industries. And I'm sorry, I don't remember which ones they are. I just remember seeing a recent study on that. But things like displays and certain types of advanced materials and things like that, you don't see those as a consumer. But even though, for example, many of those are in the iPhone, you don't see them. So other countries are doing very, very good in some kinds of innovation that we don't see. A good example of that is solar panel technology, solar energy. A decade ago, we had 55% of the global market was being produced in the United States. Today, we have less than 5%.
Oh, that's quite shocking, 5%. So do you have added recommendations or roadmaps for regaining the global innovation advantage by 2020?
You know, absolutely. I actually think this is not insurmountable. Before I'll answer that, just think about it. I think the interesting point is kind of where the United States is, and frankly, I think where Canada is. We have a chapter in the book that explains and documents the causes of UK, United Kingdom industrial decline and innovation decline, because we think it has a lot of parallels to the United States. It turns out that the United Kingdom is even worse off, Great Britain is even worse off than the United States, as they've lost much more of their industrial base, their technology base. And I'll give them credit. They're really working hard now to fix that, but you're not in anywhere near as good a shape as the United States is. But anyway, what's interesting is they may be past the tipping point of having lost so much that it's extremely hard for them to fix it. United States isn't there yet, I don't believe. But we're heading in that direction. So I think we've got another decade, and if we don't act in that decade time, then we will be past a tipping point, perhaps like the UK. But what are those things we've got to do? We have what we call a little mnemonic called the four T's, tax, trade, technology, and talent. And on tax, we've got to have a much better corporate tax code. You compare us to Canada, for example. Our statutory rate is, I believe it's 7 points higher than the Canadian statutory rate. Your research and development tax credit is about 3.5 times more generous than ours. Your tax treatment of new investment in new equipment, including software and IT equipment, is much more better than ours. And that's true around the world. The U.S. tax code simply isn't competitive, and companies will, at the margin, not invest here as much. Second is talent. You compare us to a country like Germany, which does a much, much better job of really inculcating high levels of talent in their technician base, and their engineering base. We don't do anywhere near as good a job there. We basically leave our talent production up to companies acting on their own, and U.S. companies now invest half of what they did a decade ago in training their workers. So that's number two. Number three is technology. When you look at where the United States is, as I mentioned, universities before, but you look at the growth of government research and development support, we're three times less than Canada over the last decade. We're six times less than Sweden. We're about 10 times less than Korea. Japan has exceeded us. Germany's exceeded us. Other countries have continued to expand their government support for research and development, particularly in the non-defense area. We haven't done that. We're still resting on our laurels. So we've got to do things like that. And then the other thing, by the way, that's important, other countries have looked at our game plan and our strategy, and they've really taken a lot of good steps, not just to invest in science, but to really invest in a technology transfer ecosystem. For example, now we're one of the few countries in the world that doesn't have a national innovation foundation akin to our National Science Foundation. You know, a lot of other countries now, about 25 to 30 countries, they have national science foundations, but they also added national innovation foundations. to spur industry-university partnerships, to spur new business formation, to help with venture capital and research parks, and you name it. We don't do that very much. And lastly is trade policy. And this is an area where I think a lot of people miss is we're very, very concerned of what we call the rise of innovation mercantilism. In other words, countries that are trying to win the innovation game through a whole set of unfair practices. And it's actually good if countries are competing intensely with one another over who's got the best research universities or who's got the best R&D credit or who's got the better technology transfer programs. That's wonderful. And if we're losing because of that, that's our own fault. We should, you know, we're to blame. But that's not only what's going on. What else is going on is countries like China and Brazil and India, particularly China, engaged in serious intellectual property theft, software theft, indigenous innovation programs to force and pressure foreign companies to transfer technology, manipulating standards. So, you know, Stephen, one really good example is there are about 16 global IT standards that companies from all around the world have agreed to in a voluntary industry-led way to agree that this is going to be the standard. Chinese have violated 16 of those and put in place their own government-led standards specifically to keep foreign companies and competitors out of their markets. So that's the last T, if you will. We've really got to step up to the plate, and that's where I think countries like Canada and the United States and the Commonwealth countries in particular have got to form a strong alliance to protect innovation and free trade.
So how do we maximize the global supply of innovation to promote sustainable globalization?
Well, you know, as part of this is, you know, we're all in a race with one another. But I think if we actually go about winning the race the right way, it's a win-win situation. It's sort of like, think about it as a bunch of hockey teams in the NHL, and one team figures out that they have a new way to practice skating, and it actually makes them able to skate faster, and they start winning more games. And so the other teams figure it out too, and then they start skating faster, and all of a sudden, game of hockey is a better game than it was a few years ago. So that's the kind of innovation and competitiveness competition that we want. Expanding your research universities, figuring out how to transfer technology, supporting the building of a smart grid or a health IT system. The bad kinds of policies, though, actually detract from global innovation. So when the Chinese establish these discriminatory technology standards, all it does is it breaks up the global market and makes it essentially fragmented, and that really, really hurts innovation, particularly around IT and life sciences and things like that, where innovation industries are characterized by pretty high fixed costs. Really take a lot of money to build this thing and discover it and figure out how to do it, and then pretty low marginal costs compared to your fixed costs. And in that, in innovation industries, global markets are incredibly important to drive innovation. But if you're involved in standards manipulation or piracy, IP piracy, that really, really hurts innovation. But then the last thing also is, you know, there are big innovation challenges that the world faces, and we've got to figure out new ways of cooperating to solve them. You know, a good example is energy innovation. We're not going to solve climate change by putting a carbon tax on at $20 a ton. It's, at the end of the day, is, you know, frankly, just meaningless. We're not going to solve it by cap and trade. We're not going to solve it by subsidizing poor technology. We're going to solve it through innovation. And that's an area where I think countries need to cooperate a lot more, and we could do joint efforts cooperation to make sure that we spur more innovation. Health is another area, for example. So there's a lot of areas where we don't really have the global mechanisms to do cooperative innovation.
Well, we're down to our last couple of questions here, and you know, you do a lot of traveling, you do a lot of speaking, and so on. Do you have any interesting stories to share?
I was in Australia recently giving a speech, and Australia was developing a national innovation strategy, particularly for services, and this is, I think, really, really an interesting thing. There now are a handful of countries around the world that are looking at services innovation as a key opportunity and driver of growth. And I think there's an enormous amount of opportunity there. for, you know, the ability of having conscious strategies to drive innovation. Everybody thinks about innovation in things like the hardware industry or the biotech industry or the software industry. But thinking about services innovation, I think is a very, very good one. I'm sure other ones will come to me. That's one that just comes to me immediately from just recent travels.
And this last question is sort of open-ended in the sense that if you were conducting this interview, what questions would you ask, and then what would be your answers?
I guess I'd add one question I would ask would be why there are areas that the U.S. leads and the areas the U.S. lags, and I think that's an interesting question. Why does the U.S. lead in some areas, particularly in some IT areas, and not in others? And conversely, why do some countries do well in some and not in others? And that to me gets at sort of a failure, if you will, of some countries and the United States. We have a framework in the book of what we call that towards the end of the book, we have a discussion of big regions in the world and what their prospects are going forward, to win in innovation. So Japan and then China, India, Latin America, Europe, the U.S., et cetera. And one of the things we say is what you need to win in the global economy today in the innovation space, you need to be successful in what we call the innovation triangle. And that's really three things. One is, and I won't go into all the subcomponents of it that we list in the book, but one is one side of the triangle is the business climate. In other words, having a business climate, and a business sector that's good at innovation. I think that's actually why a lot of people think the U.S. is so good, because we actually have a very entrepreneurial, population. You know, I can say this, Stephen, being from Canada, I think Americans are more entrepreneurial than Canadians. Not to say there aren't entrepreneurial Canadians, but as a group, Americans are more entrepreneurial than Japanese, I think, for example. Chinese actually are pretty entrepreneurial. But so you've got some characters like the second, you have to have the right regulatory framework. And again, there, I think the U.S. does pretty well, particularly compared to Europe, which has much more regulatory strictures that I think hurt innovation. But the third area, the third leg of the triangle is what you would call the innovation policy leg. And that's where the United States falls down. We've relied so much on our historic strength, as well as our deeply embedded laissez-faire economic philosophy that says government doesn't have a role, that we haven't done well there. So when you look at where we do well and where we don't do well, in IT, for example, we tend to do well in areas where individual companies can do something on their own. So you think about, for example, Apple. Besides the fact that Apple couldn't have done anything without the Internet, that was a platform that Apple and all the computer companies actually have, you know, relied on, and that was a platform developed by the government. But after that platform was developed, you think about what Apple did with the iPhone or the iPad. You know, they could basically say we're gonna build this thing, and they didn't need a lot of other people to participate. They ended up creating an ecosystem of apps, which was very, very useful. And so U.S. actually does very, very well on that kind of thing, where an individual company can go in a lab, figure out something really cool, put it out in the marketplace, people can buy it, and there's no sort of chicken or egg interdependencies. But where the U.S. doesn't do well is areas where there's what you would call a chicken or egg dependency. And a really good example of that would be digital signatures as well as mobile payments. So in digital signatures, there are virtually no digital signatures in the United States, no capabilities. In other words, the ability to sign a document and authenticate yourself online. This is a very important, if you will, infrastructure for operating an advanced digital economy. But the reason there are no digital signatures is because no one accepts digital signatures, and the reason no one accepts them is because no one has them. So you're back to this chicken or egg issue. Well, you go to a country like, we just released a report on global leadership in digital signatures, and if you go back and you look at a country like Estonia, where they have almost 100% digital signature take-up by their population, they did it because they had a national strategy, a public-private partnership to advance digital signature technology. You see the same thing with the mobile payments. You see the same thing with intelligent transportation. The same thing with smart grid. You know, why have a smart grid if your appliances are stupid? Well, you're not going to have smart appliances if your grid is stupid. So again, I think that's really an area where the United States could do quite well from learning from some of the leading countries of the world that have figured out these smart public-private partnerships to drive innovation.
Now, Rob, you say if the U.S. can learn from other parts of the world, will it?
Well, you know, as Churchill once said, you can always rely on the Americans to do the right thing after they've exhausted every other possibility. And we're slowly learning. You know, the Obama administration has put in place a digital signature strategy, for example. It's very modest, if you will. We're trying to do things on health IT. A little bit here and there on smart grid. I think that's really the fundamental question you asked, Stephen, is in the book we talk about the United Kingdom, and we read a lot of books and scholarly articles on the industrial and innovation decline of the UK economy and tried to summarize them in the book. And one of the interesting questions that the scholars who looked at the UK asked was, why didn't the UK ever wake up and say, oh my gosh, we are in trouble, we're losing, we've got to change course? They didn't really do that. I mean, it's only in the last couple of years, perhaps, you could say they've done that. Why didn't they do it? And the answer for most of the scholars who looked at this was the frog in the boiling water. It just, you know, slowly gets a little bit worse. And besides, you know, you're still better off than Zimbabwe. So, you know, and I think that's really the fundamental question for the United States. You know, are we going to be this kind of slowly declining economic powerhouse and we're still richer than Zimbabwe? Or are we going to wake up and say, wait a minute, other countries are really, you know, leapfrogging us and going ahead, and it's having significant harm to the United States? I think if I were a betting person, I would say the odds are less than 50% that we will wake up. But they're not zero. There's certainly more and more people. There are a number of corporate leaders in the United States. Andrew Liveris, the CEO of Dow Chemical, Paul Otellini at Intel, a number of corporate leaders who are sounding the alarm that says we've got a Jeff Immelt at GE. So, you know, we'll see. I think after the election, regardless of who gets the presidency, there could be some more movement than we've seen in the last couple of years.
Well, it's clear we'll all be watching and intently to see what happens in the coming 5, 10, and 20 years, and kind of relating that back to your book and all of the work that you've done and your team at the IT Innovation Foundation. So, Rob, I want to thank you. You have a demanding schedule, and really appreciate you coming in today to share your experiences with the audience.
Well, Stephen, thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our interview with Dr. Robert Atkinson, founding president of the IT Innovation Foundation. Rob is an internationally acclaimed leader in technology innovation and policy, and author, Innovation Economics, The Race for a Global Advantage.